I have a migraine this morning, so I apologize for in advance for the talk, which will probably be a little brief. I occasionally listen to programs from WNYC's Radio Lab, which is quite a interesting series of shows on all kinds of topics. One was the whole notion of limits. What are the actual limits of this body-mind? What can we actually accomplish with our physical embodiment, and how do we know? And they talked to a number of different researchers, and one of the things they discovered was that it seems that when we are engaged in some particular exertion, like people who do athletic events and so forth, typically there's a time when the body is saying, okay, no more, stop. And some research indicates that this is actually a little blinking light on your dashboard in your car when you need gasoline. But even if it looks like the gauge is on or near empty, you actually have more. So this information that we get that we have reached our limit is kind of a little safety device, so that you don't run yourself completely out of all necessary resources. And then maybe you have another crisis to deal with and you won't be able to. So it always leaves this little bit of some reserve. And then they talked to a couple of people who had interesting experiences along these lines. One was a woman who, she was a PE major in college, young woman, very, very strong and athletic. And to complete her degree, she needed to have a project. So one day she found herself in Hawaii due to some traveling she was doing, and they were about to have the Hawaii Triathlon, something like that, which is, I forget the order, swimming, biking, and running, or anyway, running was the last bit. And she did quite well with the swimming and the biking. And then when it came to the running, I forget how, I think, it was a marathon, right? It's 26 miles, something like that, 26.2 miles. She was also doing fairly well in the running, and in fact, at one point, found herself ahead of the whole pack to her great surprise, because she wasn't a marathon trained person. And then, within seeing distance of the finish line, she sort of collapsed. Her legs just stopped working. She was kind of there, and in the full glare of cameras and reporters and stuff, she was kind of on hands and knees, and she felt like, well, I guess this is it. I'm not going to make it this last 100 yards or something, 50 yards to the finish line. And then she saw these two little sneakers run by her on the outside, which was the one person who was close behind her. But anyway, she said she, at some point, she used the perhaps a metaphor of, she heard a voice saying, keep going. So she basically crawled her way to the finish line. And she said, this was a completely transformative experience for her. She said she rather felt like her life took some kind of a turn there. And the basis of this was her recognition that much of the explicit communication that we're aware of in our minds is ego-based. And her experience was that whatever the phenomenon or group of phenomena was that carried her to the finish line was something beyond that. Something that transcended the person as she was accustomed to seeing it and understanding herself. So she said her life had been rather different ever since then, ever since this encounter with something beyond the day-to-day experience of the self and its limits. Then they interviewed another chap who, a Frenchman, I think, or maybe he was Canadian, I can't remember, who was did this ride across the country. I don't know what it's called, but they start in San Diego and wind up in New York or something. And they pedal all the way across the country, and it's practically nonstop. They get maybe 1 or 2 hours of sleep a night, and basically they just keep going and going and going, and people eventually, it's very common for people to start hallucinating and having all kinds of challenging and scary things happen. This chap said he was quite sure that someone was shooting at him, and or perhaps it was one of the other competitors, and his crew was kind of traveling with him. I guess they had pace cars and various things. And he was saying, "My God, they're shooting at us!" And so his crew would, after a quick conference, decided to say, "Yes, they are. They're shooting at you. Hurry, hurry!" So got back on his bike and started riding. Really at the absolute limit of his endurance. And so he had a similar, but in a way, the opposite experience of the woman in the triathlon, because he also, he said at some point they had stopped for one of their brief stops, and he said his body-mind was completely quiet, whereas there had been all kinds of, you know, chatter and, "Oh my God, this is terrible, and they're shooting at me," blah, 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 and he said it just stopped. And in the midst of that, he heard a, quote, voice, unquote. But this one was saying, "It's enough." So he left the race. Also having had the experience that this manifestation was, again, something beyond the naively understood confines of the self. So in one story, the message was, keep going. And in the other story, the message was, stop. And they were both this genuine, this true voice, this voice that is beyond the self-protective web or nexus of our the topography of our body mind that is as a result of our self clinging. So this is our experience of practice is quite similar in some respects. We learn in the midst of this practice not to take us at face value all of the productions of this body-mind, particularly in retreat circumstances, we may feel quite, you know, strapped, and yet at the same time realize that there's no harm is being done. And that even though we're kind of cringing away from the experience of, you know, more stillness and so forth, or sitting in the zendo or having another meal, there's actually there are actually possibilities there, that if we had not bothered to do this study of the self, we wouldn't see. We'd constantly be relying on the learned parameters of our selfhood, and as a result, our experience of our own life would be rather narrow. So this experience we have of allowing our own inner dialogue, our own inner critic, our own inner observer to be silent, to fall silent, not to be made silent, but to fall silent, makes it possible for the curtain to be raised on the actual shape of the self, which is something that can hardly be dreamed of. So I might just as soon have been in bed this morning, but I thought this will be my Harper Street triathlon this morning, and I will manage to get up in time for service and sit a period and then give a talk. All the while there's some little objection. It's like, no, go back to bed. But actually I can hear that that is a shallow voice. And the deeper voice is saying, well, this is okay. So practice encourages and supports that kind of experience, the result of which is quite a deepening and enriching of our life, such that eventually birth and death are seen to be a single jewel. And really, all you have to do is sit there and continue to study the self in motion and in stillness and sickness and health, in success and in failure. And you will eventually see that the door is open, not shut. And that the self is this constantly given kind of samadhi. Dogen, as you know, calls the self-fulfilling samadhi. What we call the self is a strain of music or a long epic poem. That is unconfined by habitual understandings. Even though they're there, sure they're there, but they can't really confine us. And for this reason, you know, we're cautioned over and over again to be very attentive to our attempts to you know, make various things happen in our practice. Because reality is the way it is, because the self is the way it is, this practice of just sitting and allowing all conceivable phenomena to arise and pass away unhindered is established over and over again as the Buddhist practice. And I've said many times, the more we practice this, the more stuff that we thought was essential is revealed to be extraneous and dispensable. We just let it go. And then the work of great peace is seen to be not an individual effort particularly, but something that is ongoing and in which we all participate very, very deeply. This is a tremendous benefit to, you should pardon the expression, self and others. And of course, our Zen stories, you know, they point us in this direction. The kinds of circumstances that they tend to describe are, you know, at least if we're talking about the traditional stories, they are most pertinent in some ways to Chinese culture. They demonstrate, against the background of Chinese culture, at least a certain facet of it, that the participants, the interlocutors, were not confined by the categories of engagement of body, speech, and mind that they found in their day-to-day life. Reading a story where minister, one of the people in the imperial government, went to visit a teacher named Tsufu, and Tsufu heard him coming up the path, so he opened the door and looked out. Saw the minister approach, and when the minister drew near, Tsufu drew a circle in the air. And the minister says, "My coming up here has already missed the point. How much more so drawing circles?" Whereupon Tsufu went back inside and slammed the door. Later on, Master Shui Do said, the minister only had one eye. So normally if someone who conceivably has the power of life and death over you comes to your door, you might be inclined to be hospitable, but Master Tsufu was not interested in that. And fortunately, the visiting minister was also a Zenist, otherwise there might have been some trouble, but Tsufu thought nothing of slamming the door in his face. So this is, these are possibilities of consciousness and behavior that are, it's not a matter of pretending that the actualities of our circumstances don't exist. It's a matter of seeing through them all the way. And then one can respond appropriately according to the circumstance, even if it, you know, looks a little funny. Even if it seems to flout various conventions, it does so in a way that is liberating. So this is a possibility for all of us. This is a possibility that study and practice of Dharma makes available. Master Tsufu is in Master Guishan's line, where they make, or at least made, heavy use. I don't think there are any people in that lineage around anymore, but they made quite a lot of use of circular diagrams and figures. One authority said they had like 97 circular diagrams. Some of them you may have seen in the context of the so-called five ranks teaching, totally black circle, totally empty circle, and so forth. But in honor of the minister's visit, Master Sufu simply drew a circle. That too is a very special and potent kind of hospitality. And according to Shuai Do, the minister only had one eye. It was okay, you know, to say, oh, this misses the point, but it also would have been okay to come in and have tea with the master, to continue the conversation. That too would have been fine. So the more we practice, the more that voice that is saying, keep going, or stop here, becomes familiar and immediately accessible. This is a tremendous help in our lives. If we sit here long enough, I'll think of something else to say, but maybe that's not so necessary. I was saying to somebody the other day, I can't remember who, you notice that in the Ehe Koroku, Dogen's record of his, pretty much his monastic instruction, the talks are very short. Sometimes a couple of sentences, sometimes a paragraph. So sometimes at Zen Center, my own beloved teacher, occasionally, particularly during Sesshin, you know, the lecture will be like 2 hours long or more, including usually question and answer. So that could be fun too, but it's also not necessary. So much talking. However, perhaps somebody has a question or would like to make a comment. Yes.
That the minister only had one eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very curious remark.
Yeah.
Also, the minister's reaction was, it seems, to be offended.
Was to be offended?
Yeah. It seems he was offended.
I don't know if he was offended or, he was kind of doing the Zen thing. Like, you know, my visit already missed the point. How about you? And so that was okay. Shuai Do says, it's a little lopsided. You only have one eye, not both.
So he was trying to do the Zen thing.
He was very, this guy, what was his name? Can't remember. Anyway, he was celebrated as a lay practitioner of Chan, and a well-respected one. And in the commentary of this story, the commentator mentions several other celebrated ministers and people in government who were known as Chan adepts also. But it's part of the game that you can always say that somebody who appears in a story, they were okay, but they only got 70% of it. You're allowed to do that. It's part of the rules of discourse. You can say, pretty good, but not quite enough. Yes.
So I was impressed by the stories of the people who are making this incredible effort. I mean, it's sort of beyond egotistical. You have this one single-minded, for no particular reason other than to run the race or to get there first or to push yourself to the maximum.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly were not, that didn't in any way prevent them from getting a message.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought the lineage diagrams that bifurcate.
Yes.
Because they have the Rinzai side and the Soto side.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a little footnote at the bottom that says essentially somebody who who really should know, took me aside and told me that these are both just
yes,
this, you know, equivalent, right, and fine. You know?
Right.
So I'm wondering if this is what was going on. You know, you can say, you know, the approach is to have no gating idea at all. Or you can just sort of shoot the moon, but either way.
And have nothing but gaining idea.
Nothing but gaining idea, right.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And the nothing but gaining idea has certain currency and a certain attraction for some folks. But the practice or the discipline or the effort of just sitting is a bit different. Even if you, even if it's possible to go completely for broke with gaining idea, at some point the idea will be relinquished also. Even in the midst of that intense practice on introspection, even then gaining idea has to be relinquished. So it's a, you'd say it's a matter of style and taste as much as anything. Yes.
Was it clear what the meaning or intention of drawing the circle was, and whether or not the minister correctly interpreted it?
Well, there's nothing to interpret particularly. It wasn't a symbolic gesture so much. It was, you could say, the opening of a conversation. Yeah. And then the minister responded the way he did, and then Master Tzu Fu responded the way he did. And Shui Do, I think, was saying, you know, this could have gone on longer, this conversation. It might have been even more helpful and more interesting. But alas, the minister only had one eye. So. Yes.
He was proud.
Huh?
He was proud, would you say?
Mm. Not necessarily. He just, maybe he was being too zen. Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Sometimes some of these stories have a, they strike me as having a certain improvisational play quality,
yes,
to them.
Yes, quite.
You know, like a couple of musicians just tune,
right,
on their instruments.
Yes, yes. Yeah, quite so. Yeah. Yes. In fact, I think there are even some improv teachers who have used some of these stories as, you know, a little practice scenario for their improv students. So, yeah. Yes.
So, carrying on what Larry was saying,
mm-hmm,
maybe one difference in these two people's stories is that the marathon runner had actually given up.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And then she was free to go.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah, maybe.
Whereas the other guy seemed to have experienced some real madness.
Yeah.
And then had to give up.
Hmm. Yeah. Of course, there was that significant that he experienced first a very, very deep quiet. Said, in fact, I think he said, if I remember, that he had never experienced a silence like that before in his body mind. So, so the voice that he heard saying it's enough wasn't in the midst of some extreme agitation, but quite the contrary. So the feeling I got from both of these stories was that each of the people involved was able to hear the still small voice, to use the biblical term. They were able to hear it. And the extremity of their physical circumstance helped set the stage for that. But there's other ways to do that, rather than you know, trying to completely exhaust yourself physically and mentally. You can do that, but it's also possible to become acquainted with that voice in, as Dogen might say, in the midst of everydayness. rather than trying to push yourself into some corner. So, anyway, that's something I profoundly appreciate about our teaching. Yes.
Yeah, small, just a voice. I was tripping on Luke a couple of weeks ago. He took such good notes.
Luke in the Bible?
Yeah.
How about that?
Hey, good note taker is important. Mm-hmm. And so when Jesus says, somebody says, well, but, the Jews are hard to convince, but just, someone rose from the dead, then they get it.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, what he said. He said, they have Abraham and the prophets, and they still don't hear it. So if someone rose from the dead, it wouldn't make any difference.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, no, that's
a... That's a good one.
And I thought, well, that, yeah. So I just, that's a small stuff. Oh, it's all over again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there is such a voice. Recommend to all of us that we cultivate the ear that hears it. Or as has also been said, don't think that you can hinder the one who hears it. This is quite important. Yes.
Where is that quote from?
That is a kind of a riff on a quote of a dialogue between the sixth ancestor and his descendant, our direct ancestor, Ching Yuan, the famous one where, it's from Teaching of the Insentient, from that story, which I can show you if you like. It's too long to tell now, especially in my current condition. But there's a point where someone says, this teaching that insentient beings or insentient objects proclaim the Dharma, I can't hear it. I don't hear it. And then the national teacher, Nanyang Wei Chong, says, you may say you can't hear it, but you can't hinder the one who hears it. So that's the same with the still small voice. The one who hears it can't be interfered with.
In the 21st century, we have to say, you might not like the program, but you can't deny that the set is working.
Ah, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. I don't know if people talk about the still small voice anymore. Maybe some places they do. Maybe the Quakers do, among others. Yeah.
I'm not sure what the still small voice. I've been thinking a lot lately about language and words as opposed to getting a sort of more direct image or sense. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to say this, but sometimes the small voice sounds like this auditory thing that's going on, and now I'm doing this, or now I'm doing this, or
yeah.
A voice that comes with instructions. I mean, I'm just questioning the delivery system of language at the moment.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So when I heard that still small voice, I sort of had that little resistance of like, how else could it come more directly?
Well, the still small voice doesn't necessarily use words.
Okay.
Although when people talk about it, they're trying to language it, right?
Yeah.
Speak ungrammatically. They're trying to language that experience, mm-hmm. So it comes out sounding like that, but I think both the cases of the marathon runner and the bicyclist, when they said they heard a voice, it was more metaphorical.
Okay.
It's more like a holistic, integral impression that was inarguably true,
mm-hmm.
to them. Possibly apart from language completely. Well, I've earned my rice. Maybe that's enough for now. I don't think I have any announcements to make. when I lived here in 95. Philip Whalen and I were often taking turns giving talks. We're often like 5 or 6 people here. So it's an old tradition. I don't know where everybody is, but that's how it is. Thank you very much.